Welcome to the Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. It certainly is the mission of PRN and this program to broadcast vital truths with top hosts, top guests, and nothing else is acceptable. That's what listeners tune in for, and that's what they get. So I'm proud to be a small part of that. And I've got a marvelous guest on today. He's been on before. I sure hope I'll get him back many more times. Rick Rosehoff is my guest. Rick is an activist. He's an anti-war supporter. He's the editor of the vital website that everybody should know about and follow. It's called Stop NATO. And in Rick's words, he says, it documents and opposes global militarist trends and an expanding theater of warfare that began, and in my words, by balkanizing Yugoslavia in the 1990s. And the horrors never end, and of course they're going on in too many places, let's put it that way. Rick, I welcome you to the program. I understand the constraints you're under today, so I'm loose and flexible, and I'll let you go in whatever direction you wish. Welcome.
Yeah, thank you, Stephen, and I'd be remiss if I didn't first of all commend you and remind your listeners of the indispensable job you've been doing yourself with the daily articles, really, of the most vital importance, particularly on the Syrian crisis. And your contributions are not only penetrating and valuable, they're unique in their consistency, and I'm deeply in your debt, as is all peace-loving humanity.
Rick, you really overwhelm me with that, and I'm very grateful, and I feel the same about what you do. I don't know anybody that knows more about NATO and tells it truthfully and fully, and that's what you do on Stop NATO. It's so important. I have my own terminology for NATO. I call it a killing machine. A killing machine. Who ever heard of a defensive alliance that goes around waging imperial wars, starting, I guess, around the mid-1990s, Rick? Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they've waged acts of military aggression since at least 1995 and have intensified it now, as you're alluding to three continents. Again, the so-called North Atlantic Treaty Organization has waged wars in Southeastern Europe, South Asia, and North Africa, and is itching to get into the fray, of course, in the Middle East and Syria.
Oh, I can feel it, and I can taste it, Rick. I drafted another article on Syria this morning. As a matter of fact, I have two of them. I got ahead of myself, and I have one on Syria that was done, but I didn't get it out today. It was a little less time-sensitive than a couple of others I wanted to get out. So now I've got a second article on Syria, a daily double on Syria, Rick, going out tomorrow. You know, unless there's a massive false flag attack I have to say something about, and then I may delay one of the Syria articles. You never know what's going to happen. Today has a long way to go. But yeah, I honestly believe that that NATO wants to get involved in Syria. And, of course, Turkey is a NATO country bordering on Syria. And Prime Minister Erdogan made such hostile comments. I quoted him in one of my articles that the one I drafted this morning. I mean, he's just itching to get into a fight. He's a little bit vague in what he says, but he basically says that he's got the right to, do what he damn pleases. He's worried about the PKK. He's taking orders from Washington, and Washington pulls the strings, and he's sitting there on the border. He's providing safe havens to these terror gangs, these death squads, funneling them and weapons across the border. Rick, I'll let you talk about that and a lot more.
Yeah, thanks for that. And you're drawing absolutely the correct parallels. A recent article appeared, I think I saw in Global Research in Canada, that drew a parallel yet that I had not yet thought about, which was, the Central American Contra Wars of the early 1980s of the Reagan administration, particularly in Nicaragua, but also in Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras, and that the model is not unlike, what is being employed currently against Syria, which is to say that bordering countries with close military ties to the United States, not only Turkey but Jordan, and increasingly, at least in relation to the military, Lebanon, are being used as safe havens for harboring cross-border paramilitaries and terrorists in many instances, many of whom are not Syrian nationals, as you've documented, Stephen. That is, they're assorted jihadis, from around the Arab world, North Africa, and the Middle East, and that the parallel with what the Reagan-Alexander Haig administration did in the early 1980s to Nicaragua and in El Salvador and Guatemala is a pretty striking parallel. Other observers have pointed out the fact that the U.S. is also employing the original Afghan model, which is to say receiving monies and logistical support from the Persian Gulf sheikhdoms in the first, or kingdoms and sheikhdoms in the first place, Saudi Arabia, also Qatar and United Arab Emirates, much as the U.S. did from 1978 onward vis-a-vis Afghanistan, and then training and arming armed fighters in a neighboring country, in that case Pakistan, for attacks inside Afghanistan. We're seeing something quite like that in relation to Syria. And then there's also the Kosovo model, which is, again, pretty much the same thing. An armed insurgency armed and trained by the United States operating out of contiguous countries, in the case of Kosovo, Albania, and Macedonia. So, the State Department and Defense Department script hasn't changed dramatically in the last 30 years. And I would wish, as I'm sure you do, and many of your listeners do, that a lot of people who ordinarily are pro-peace or anti-interventionists who have permitted themselves, in my estimate, to be misled on what's going on in Syria, and not only internally, but, the broader context of those developments, would look at the historical parallels. And when you see the same scenario played out time after time, to not fall for the standard propaganda, humanitarian interventionist propaganda in the first instance, that is being purveyed by the U.S. and its media outlets.
Oh, absolutely. Humanitarian intervention and a responsibility to protect. The law is twisted. The ideology is really so oppressive, Rick. The article, by the way, that I quote in my article to go out tomorrow in Turkey's Hurriyet Daily, their headline of the article is PM, Prime Minister, meaning Erdogan, PM declares Syria intervention, and then in his words, a natural right.
Oh, my God, I wasn't aware of them. And we have to remember that Erdogan is the head of state.
He's the head of state, Prime Minister, indeed. Yeah. He's got people in Turkey who are very much opposed to what he's doing, but he's the head guy, and he's a NATO member, and Washington is pulling the strings, and if Obama says go do it, then who knows what they'll do, and they could have he pulled a stunt with the warplane crossing into Syrian airspace, mm-hmm. and everything that Erdogan said about it was a lie, and what Syria reported was truthful, and this was a provocation. Syria had every right to shoot the damn thing down. Coming in at low altitude at high speed, my goodness gracious.
We both speculated, and you quite poignantly, that this was a Gulf of Tonkin type provocation. In other words, it was to not only to test the air defenses of Syria, but essentially begging Syria to shoot the plane down, which then provided Turkey, as you'd mentioned earlier, to go to NATO headquarters and invoke Article 4 mutual support from the other 27 members of the alliance, preparatory to invoking Article 5, which is a mutual war clause. We also have to recall this is the same Turkish government that in January of this year allowed the U.S. to activate an X-band interceptor missile radar station in the country, and what one unnamed U.S. official at the time remarked as being the most substantive act of military cooperation between Turkey and the United States in the last 30 years. So, attempts by the Turkish government to portray itself as pursuing an independent foreign policy are disingenuous at best. And what in fact has happened, I think we're seeing a continuation of Clinton era, President Bill Clinton era, division of labor between the United States and Turkey, where and this was, absent during the George W. Bush administration, where Turkey has allowed its sphere of influence, which is increasingly broader, And that includes not only Southeastern Europe, the Balkans, but, you know, presumably throughout the Turkic-speaking areas of Central Asia into Afghanistan. But the new twist in this, of course, is the fact that Turkey is pursuing what's alternately been referred to as a neo-Ottoman or Sunni strategy to reassert its influence in the Arab world, which means both in the Middle East and North Africa. So Syria is a major test case. Turkey, of course, was played a supporting role in the six-month bombing campaign, a naval blockade against Libya last year. But in the case of Syria, which it borders, this is much more direct role. And as you're intimating, Turkey will be used as the frontline state for provoking a confrontation with Syria, and being a NATO member, of course, would then permit the United States, France, Britain, Germany, and other NATO powers to intervene against Syria, allegedly in defense of fellow NATO member Turkey.
It really is scary, Rick, and Turkey could get into the Libyan conflict without too much worry about its own security. Gaddafi couldn't attack back into Turkish territory, but Turkey, of course, borders on Syria, and Syria has a much stronger military than Gaddafi did, and if Turkey attacks, Syria can fight back. You know, I guess Turkey has the most powerful military force in the region after Israel. I don't think Turkey has nuclear weapons. Israel sure does.
Turkey has some 63 U.S. Tactical nuclear bombs placed in the Incirlik, NATO air base.
Controlled by the Pentagon, though.
Yeah, in theory, but it's part of what's called burden sharing with NATO, which is to say, the B-61 tactical nuclear bombs are American, but the arrangement with NATO is that warplanes of the respective host nations, the others are Germany, Belgium, Netherlands, and Italy, would deliver the nuclear war bombs, so that Turkey could, in theory, with U.S. connivance, of course, deliver atomic bombs not only to its Syrian neighbor, but let's be honest, the other major military power in the area is also a neighbor of Turkey, and that's Iran.
Oh, indeed, and to my knowledge, Iran and Turkey have good relations. Any information you have on that, Rick?
Well, on the surface, the so-called no enemies policy of the current Turkish regime, at least on the surface, they pretend to have good state-to-state relations with Iran. But by subverting the only nation in the Arab world that Iran could consider to be a reliable ally, Syria, the argument can be made persuasively, I'm convinced, that Turkey is waging a proxy war, conflict with Iran inside Syria, in relation to Syria, by undermining and, ultimately overthrowing the only Arab government that is a close ally of Iran, and incidentally, the only Arab government that is a close and dependable ally of Russia.
That very much is a big issue. There's no question about that, and I'm sure the Iranians think about that, and I'm sure they've had discussions with Erdogan and other Turkish officials.
Yeah, I suspect. I mean, I'm not privy to what communication, and you can read the press releases when respective government leaders get together and talk. But behind that, is Turkey's role again in hosting the U.S. NATO missile interceptor X-band radar station, clearly aimed against Iran. That's incontestable. So that what Turkish officials say, to the media, and what they do in fact are diametrically opposed.
Another big point in my mind is, and I've written a couple of times about this, Turkish-Israeli relations, on the surface, there's a lot of friction. Anything that you know that may indicate it is a little bit different beneath the surface?
Again, I can't claim to be to know all the intricacies, and what we know is what's on the surface again. But, there's conflict with Turkey and Israel right now around oil, natural gas exploration off the coast of Cyprus, not the northern Turkish Cyprus Republic, but Nicosia. So there's still friction between Israel and Turkey, however. Israel remains a stalwart, a major member of NATO's Mediterranean Dialogue military partnership. There were rumors in May when the NATO summit was held here in Chicago that Turkey had somehow blocked Israel participating in a partnership meeting. So, there could be friction. But if Turkey is to pursue a neo-Ottoman policy to reassert its influence after a century in the Arab world, then on superficially, they have to portray themselves as standing up to Israel, I would suspect, you know, whether or not they do so in any substantive manner. But by working against the government in Syria, with all that portends for the entire region, Lebanon in the first instance, I think one could make the better argument that Turkey is furthering Israeli interest in the Arab world in relation, in the first place, with Syria and with Lebanon.
Oh, that could very well be, Rick. There's one sticking point with Turkey and how serious it is. You've got to try to separate the rhetoric from what people really feel in a country. But going back to May, the end of May 2010, I believe it was, the Freedom Flotilla that tried to get into Gaza, and Israelis intercepted it and killed about 9 Turkish nationals. And Israel never apologized. Israel was willing to pay compensation to family members. Turkey demanded an apology. And, you know, Washington never says it's sorry. Israel never says it's sorry. And all this time later, many months, Israel still has not apologized. And there's a Turkish court that indicted Israeli IDF commanders relating to that incident. And there were, I believe, a preliminary hearing held, and I think a court trial is scheduled for sometime in November. I wrote about what I knew about it a few months ago, but apparently there is a Turkish court. Now, I don't know whether the government's going to allow this to get very far, but there's a Turkish court that wants to have a very, very detailed proceeding where any family member relating to the people who were killed can come into court and can testify whatever they know and so on and so forth. But this seems to be a very hostile act against another state. Of course, Pakistan was very upset that the Pentagon killed its soldiers after Pakistan, while the attack was ongoing, notified U.S. authorities that you're firing at our people. Stop. And the firing kept continued, and Pakistani soldiers were killed. Well, apparently that's been smoothed away. I don't know why. Hillary Clinton didn't really apologize, even though Pakistan said she did. But it's hard to imagine that these events, even though they stick in your craw, will end up really disrupting relations between two countries.
Now, you've drawn a vital parallel between the NATO-U.S. attack and Salalah, the outpost in Salalah in Pakistan last November. They killed 24 service members, Pakistani service members, and the attack on the Freedom Flotilla that killed Turkish nationals. You know, in both cases, what choice do the respective governments have but to condemn the attacks?
You know, they're going to do it for political reasons. You know, the home front is very angry, and as you know, Rick, there are protests all the time in Pakistan. They should be angry. My God, you've got these drones killing civilians, and Pakistanis are absolutely outraged. I wrote one article, and I hope the data I used was right, but if I can remember the numbers that I put in, it's something like, and this might have been a year ago now, something like what America has given Pakistan post 9/11 amounts to maybe about $18 billion. And in return, the cost to Pakistan has been something like $60 billion. Mm. So it's been a net huge loss for Pakistan. And you've got to wonder why they put up with this kind of stuff.
No, those are intriguing and valuable figures. And the Pakistani government has said that repeatedly, that's an economic loss for them, you know, the so-called global war on terror and supporting the U.S.-NATO war in Afghanistan. But in addition, I mean, Pakistan itself has lost more service members, more troops in fighting in, the northwest of the country in the federally administered tribal areas than have the United States and NATO in Afghanistan. So they've paid a cost in both blood and treasure, you know, outstripping any potential gains they've received as a result of it. Not that you would know that by listening to loud mouths in both houses of U.S. Congress, who are constantly excoriating Pakistan, you know, for not wiping out the last military age male in the northwest of the country. And of course, the U.S. is attempting to do that to the best of its ability by killing some 3,000 people in drone attacks. These are Pakistani nationals, and notwithstanding U.S. claims that each and every one of these 3,000 some odd people killed were, terrorists imminently on the verge of, murdering U.S. citizens or something, which is nonsense. That you know, Pakistan is expected to the government Islamabad is expected to commit political suicide, essentially, to prove its loyalty to the United States, and may end up doing so. That is committing political suicide.
Oh, it could very well, and I mean, Pakistan has its own internal problems, and to get mixed up in America's imperial wars, Rick, I'm getting up in years, and I don't know
Aren't
if
we
I.
We both, Steve.
next month I'll be 78. I call myself a young 78. Still lots of life left in this old warhorse. But I dream that I could live long enough to see the day where, in diplomatic language, growing numbers of countries will tell America to go to hell. In diplomatic language, of course. But why these countries get involved in American imperial wars, it really defies me. I'm certain there are a lot of threats and this and that and whatever that go back and forth between officials in various countries. You remember when, right after 9/11, when, what was his name, the assistant, Bush's assistant defense secretary, what was his name?
Paul Wolfowitz?
No, not Wolfowitz. I can't think of it. Anyway.
May be trying to forget him.
He's long gone now, doing other mischief in some other capacity. But he paid head of Pakistan visit, the general. I can't spit his name.
Musharraf,
exactly. He paid him a visit and said, I think in less than diplomatic language, Rick, something like, we can either give you billions of dollars or we'll bomb you back to the Stone Age.
Yeah. Yeah, I can remember seeing Musharraf on one of the Sunday morning news programs in the United States right after 9/11. And if you wanted to see somebody almost paralyzed with terror, I can't describe any other in any other words the impression that he made upon me, where he almost with a gun to the back of his head, to be honest. Not that he wasn't willing to accede to U.S. demands, but the threat must have been so stark that he looked absolutely horrified and almost trembling. That's the kind of back channel, diplomatic communication that Washington is in the habit of exercising. But you raise another question that, is probably the topic of an entire show sometime. But it's a fact that so many of the world's nations are willing to go along with U.S. foreign policy decisions is, I would argue, probably the most disturbing trend of our times. And I'm thinking, most recently with Russia and China having for the third time, this is unprecedented. Nothing like this has occurred in the history of the United Nations, for the third time jointly vetoed a Western-sponsored resolution targeting Syria. And, previous to this, Russia and China, I believe, had only jointly vetoed two resolutions, one on Myanmar, one on Zimbabwe, but this is three times since October on Syria. But to look at the vote in the UN Security Council, there are five NATO members currently there. They're permanent members, Britain, France, and the United States, and I believe Germany and Portugal are there. So you have five NATO members of 15, current members of the UN Security Council. That is, a full third of them are NATO members. But the vote broke down with Russia and China vetoing it. Pakistan, revealingly, I think, alluding to our early, what we were talking about earlier, that, Pakistan realizes they can well be the next Syria. So Pakistan, South Africa abstaining, but the other 11 members of the Security Council, including India, voting in favor of that. And if we look at comparable votes in the UN's Human Rights Council, in the General Assembly, and so forth, we would be missing the main point of the post-Cold War era, in my estimate, if we didn't look. It's 194 members of the United Nations. And if I had to tick off on the number of those who cannot be counted on to vote the U.S. line in the United Nations on any other issue, let's say, than the Israel-Palestine issue, it's perhaps as few as a dozen countries, Stephen.
It is really shocking, Rick.
And, meaning the economic, the military, the political, the subversive penetration of other countries has been so extensive, so thorough in the post-Cold War period that the U.S. has neutralized, if not recruited, the governments, and certainly not the peoples, of most every nation in the world. So if you're looking at resistance right now, we're not talking about challenging the United States. We're simply talking about not towing the U.S. line. In my estimate, you have Russia, China, and Iran, of course, North Korea, at times Belarus, Zimbabwe, Eritrea in northwest Africa, sometimes Sudan, and at least five members of the Bolivarian Alliance for the Peoples of Our America, ALBA, which would be Bolivia, Venezuela, Ecuador, Cuba, Nicaragua. But, you know, I defy your listeners to name any other country in the world that could be counted on to stand up to the United States, even in something as simple as the United Nations vote.
Oh, that's so true. And I've had a Japanese expert on this program a couple of times, and I said to him, it's really astonishing, and I doubt that few people think about it, but Japan has been occupied by the U.S. military since 1945. I mean, it's astonishing, and I said to him on the air, when will Japan grow up and start acting like an adult? I mean, it acts like a child. Here, this strong nation, an economic power, and they act like a child. And South Korea, same thing, act like a child. South Korea has been occupied. My God, Germany has been occupied. Why do these countries put up with letting U.S. troops stay on their soil, have bases, bases related to the wars that America fights? Why do they do this?
Yeah, as we were talking about earlier, Germany permits the stationing of U.S. nuclear weapons in its country to this day.
And they,
you know, why do Germans tolerate that? Why, after the reunification of Germany in 1990, did the U.S. not pull its military completely out? Forget about strategic assets like nuclear bombs. And why has the world tolerated this?
Well, I feel that way. I think the day will come, Rick. You know, what can't go on forever won't. And the policies of America are so destructive to its allies, its partners. You know, the core ones, I guess they all work together. My nominees for the Axis of Evil are America, Britain, and Israel. But, you know, you could throw France in there and Germany. Germany's involved. They're kind of silent. They do their stuff a little bit quietly. I mentioned that in one of my articles for tomorrow. France is more outspoken. Doesn't matter whether it's Hollande or Sarkozy. Britain, my God, you know, Gordon Brown or David Cameron, William Hague, the foreign minister.
Let's not forget Tony Blair.
Tony Blair.
You know, there's a couple of both major political parties in the country.
Oh, I wrote an article about him some years ago, and I called it, I still remember the title, it was one of my good titles, Reinventing a War Criminal.
Well, you know, it was here in Chicago in the spring of 1999 during the bombing of Yugoslavia, which was a test case, presumably, where the so-called Blair Doctrine was announced by Blair himself, that, you know, the world community, meaning, you know, the one-eighth of the human race that inhabits NATO countries, the one-eighth, but, you know, arrogates to itself, you know, the title of world community and decides it can operate within or outside the United Nations to topple the governments of any country in the world, that, you know, whenever they can invoke, you know, a plausible humanitarian pretext for doing so, that they had the right to do just that, to militarily intervene around the world. And, you know, in fact, after 78 days of, you know, bombing Yugoslavia, in 1999, Tony Blair moved on to Sierra Leone and then on to Iraq, Afghanistan and Iraq and, you know, Libya and so forth. And, yeah, I only have to assume that U.S. military supremacy being what it is, that other governments are quite frankly terrified, you know, even major governments in some cases, and are making concessions that, in my estimate, of course, are unwise, because the more you give a ravenous beast, the more he's coming for. And it's only a matter of time. There was an article on Voice of Russia, which is a government radio station, but on the online edition on the website the other day, saying if, you know, if Russia does, I'm sorry, this is a Strategic Culture Foundation from Russia, but by a major Middle East expert in Russia, stating that, you know, Russia ought to shore up its military facility in Tartus in Syria, not only for the defense of Syria, but for the defense of Russia, stating, you know, if Syria falls and Iran follows, it won't be too long before a so-called Russian spring appears on their own doorstep. So, you know, there's a question of, you know, how much you concede to the world's sole military superpower, and that phrase, by the way, is from Obama's Nobel Peace Prize acceptance speech in December of 1999, where he took ownership of that title and boasted of it. So, I mean, the world cannot, and the peoples of the world cannot pretend not to know what is happening. You know, a lot of people prefer to keep their heads in the sand, but I think, you know, there's a point at which we've got to grab them by the lapel, Stephen.
Oh, absolutely, Rick.
And remind them of what we're really talking about.
We're just about out of time. I wish we keep this going, but I honestly believe, I look at America, Rick, as a bully, and a bully likes to pick on weaker foes. And I honestly believe if a country like Russia and China or any nuclear power drew a line in the sand and said, I'm not so certain America will want a confrontation if they could get a bloody nose themselves from doing it. Bullies usually back off. It's been a long time ago. I wrote about comparing America to a schoolyard bully. Schoolyard bully doesn't like to go up against anybody who can land equal blows. We'll have to talk about this in a future program, Rick. We are plumb out of time. Look forward to getting you back again. Oh, absolutely, without any question.
Well, thank you so much, Stephen.
Thank you, Rick.
I'll talk to you soon.
You betcha.
Bye.
And I always remind my listeners, every Thursday, of course, we're on 11 a.m. Eastern Time. We're on weekends at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Make it a regular habit for guests like Rick and Vital Topics. And we'll talk about all of them at one program or another. Join us.